Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. A Book, A Thousand Stories sees the continuation of last week's episode, where we saw the arrival of the Nazis in Vienna and its immediate effect on Jewish households. For what happened in the Effrussi Palais happened in the homes of all their co-religionists and all free thinkers in Vienna. All day Luftwaffe planes fly over Vienna. All day there are arrests of anyone who has supported any previous political party. Journalists, financiers, civil servants, Jews. Schuschnigg is in solitary confinement. Crowds march along the Ringstrasse chanting Deutschland über alles. People are picked up from the streets and sent to Dachau. The Gutmanns, the Rothschilds, have left. Some people are stuck in police stations. Victor manages to help some cousins to get across the border to Czechoslovakia. But he is frozen into immobility. He can't leave his father's and grandfather's house, the bank, his library. He simply cannot believe that his proven attachment to the fatherland can be overlooked. Rather than be associated with Jews, all the servants have left. Only the cook and faithful Anna remain, and the old porter, Herr Richner, who lives in the little room by the gate. He has conveniently gone out and left the gate to the Ringstrasse wide open the day the Nazis arrive. Men in uniform are on all the street corners. The currency is now the Reichsmark, and Judah is painted on Jewish-owned shops. The huge Schiffmann department store is systemically plundered. Pips's old friend, Egon Friedel, throws himself out of the window when he sees the stormtroopers arrive and question the porter in his apartment building. He is one of 160 Jewish suicides between March and April 1938 in Vienna alone. The pages of the book, which in earlier chapters were so airy and colourful, become hard to read and even difficult to relate to you, my listeners. The author author himself finds it difficult to delve into this period of his family's saga and to recount the tragic facts. The Cardinal of Vienna has ordered the bells of Austria to ring and the bells of the Votivkirche opposite the Palais of Fressi start pealing. The Wehrmacht march past. There is so much noise, the whole house shakes. Jewish state and municipal employees and 183 teachers are sacked. All Jewish lawyers and public prosecutors relieved of office. And they had thought themselves to be honest servants of the state. SS Lieutenant Adolf Eichmann appears on the scene. He confiscates all documents linking the IKG, the Israelite organization, to the Schuschnigg plebiscite campaign. He confiscates the IKG library, collects Judaica and Hebraica for the planned Institute for Research into the Jewish Question. In a grandiose show of alliance, on the 9th of April 1938, Hitler is driven on in a motorcade along the Ringstrasse. I wonder what Franz Josef would have thought had he known this when he built his grandiose rink fit for grandiose parades. At noon, Goebbels announces the result of the Nazi-controlled plebiscite. 99.75% have voted in favor of Anschluss. Austria has been arm-twisted into pledging its alliance to the Führer. Austrian citizens of Jewish origin were not admitted to vote. The first step towards the creation of the Greater German Reich had been taken. On 23rd April, a boycott of Jewish shops is announced. The same day, the Gestapo arrive at Palais Efrussi. Six members of the Gestapo, in perfect uniform, walk straight in. They have orders to search the home, as they have reason to believe that the Jew Efrussi supported the Schuschnigg campaign. They rummage through the 24 rooms of the family apartment, the kitchens, the servants' hall. They request the keys to the safe, to the silver room, the porcelain store, the key to the cabinet in Victor's dressing room, where he keeps the family letters and letters from his tutor, Herr Kessel, the good Prussian who had taught him good German values and made him read Schiller. They take Victor's key to the office at the bank. At the end of these long hours, Victor is found guilty of having contributed 5,000 shillings to the Schuschnigg campaign. He and Rudolf are arrested. Emmy is allowed to stay back in two back rooms, small, high, and very dark. She is not allowed to use the main staircase. She has no servants. She has, at this moment, only her clothes. For 3 days, Victor and Rudolf are kept in prison somewhere. Victor has a choice. Deportation to Dachau, for him and his son, or placing his signature on a document. He signs. And in so doing, he signs away the Palais and all its contents, and all his properties in Vienna, the accumulation of all the diligence of the family, 100 years of possessions. On 27th April 1938, number 14 Dr. Karl Luger Ring Vienna, formerly the Palais Efrussi, has been fully Aryanized. Victor and Rudolf go back to their home. They enter the open gate, walk across the courtyard and up the servants' staircase to the two rooms that are now their home. The house and all they had are no longer theirs. People are counting rooms, making lists of objects and pictures. Anna is told that she should be ashamed to have worked for the Jews. She is somewhere in the house, obliged to pack goods, those same goods she had so diligently cared for, into crates and boxes to be taken away. In the grey light from the glassed-in courtyard, all these objects from this Jewish family are held accountable. De Waal states, it is not just their art, all the gilded stuff from tables and mantelpieces, but their clothes, Emmy's winter coats, umbrellas, wedding and birthday gifts and souvenirs. This is the strange undoing of a collection of a house of a family. It is the moment of Fischer, when grand things are taken, when family objects, known and handled and loved, become stuff. Every Jewish family in Vienna is undergoing this same treatment. Their possessions will be sold or auctioned off to raise money for the Reich. Some items will be bartered with dealers for other objects. Some items will be catalogued and given to the Führer for his new museum. Other items will go to the national museums. Some pictures, furniture, books are earmarked for the collections of the Nazi leadership. Together with the properties of the House Habsburg and Lothringen, the properties of such as the Jews Gutmann and Efrussi are catalogued, photographed, placed in albums and listed by experts, art historians, architects, librarians. All is confiscated in favour of the Reichsfuhrer, the Armed Forces, the Lebensborn and others. Thank you.
The so-called Lebensborn program was as morbid and depraved as its perpetrators, starting with Himmler, who ran it. The idea was to create a master race of Aryan blue-eyed children without the slightest respect for family norms. Suitable Aryan women would be available to SS officers and others for impregnation. This would raise the birth rate of Aryan children via extramarital relations of racially pure and healthy persons. Many such births by unmarried women were anonymous. Thousands of Polish children, among others, were kidnapped for the program. These would be subjected to Germanization in re-education camps and then fostered out to German families. Nazi eugenics was an office based in Munich within Himmler's SS. In 1939, its membership stood at 8,000, of whom 3,500 were SS leaders. Orphanages were also available. Tens of thousands of such children were involved until the war ended. Homes for these Aryan children were available in Germany, Norway, Poland, and elsewhere in Europe. Lebensborn children were supposedly christened in a ritualistic Nazi ceremony. Children for the program started being kidnapped, sometimes in full view of their parents, from Russia, Ukraine, East Europe, and Nordic countries. The children would be tested to make sure they were healthy, Aryan, and had no Jewish blood. Otherwise, they were considered useless. In 1944-45, all their files were destroyed as the war was coming to an end. So thousands of these children never got to know who their biological parents were. Others, subjected to forced selective breeding, often after mating with Nazi men in the camps, were ostracized after the war, or even went mad. At least three films and one main novel have been inspired by this program. It reveals a sick mind, such as Himmler's was. But his was not the only one, as so many others were involved in different countries, not only in Germany. It is an antisocial disgrace to the human race and shows to what depths Nazism descended, gas ovens and all. It also shows to what extent purist and racial ideology can, amorally, dehumanize not just adults, but also children, and be instrumentalized for political purposes. Truly, never again. Plus jamais.
Three days after Victor and Rudolf come out of prison, the family apartment is assigned to the Office of Flood and Avalanche Control. Bedrooms become offices, and while Hitler looks over the albums and chooses what he wants, Victor's library is taken away. His history books, the Greek and Latin poetry, his Ovid and Virgil and Tacitus, the runs of English, German and French novels, the edition of Dante with the illustrations by Doré, the dictionaries, the atlases, his lifetime of reading are taken off the shelves, sorted and packed into wooden crates, nailed shut, carried away down the marble stairs and driven out through the oak doors. On 12th August, Afrossi and Co. is erased off the business register. 3 months later, the name is changed to C.A. Steinhauser. Steinhauser was Victor's partner in business. Now, under Gentile ownership, the bank is revalued. It is worth six times what it was valued when under Jewish ownership. ironically, the grand floor rooms of the Palais, Ignace's apartment of gold and marble, are handed over to the Amt Rosenberg, becoming the office of Alfred Rosenberg, plenipotentiary of the Führer for the supervision of all intellectual and ideological education and indoctrination in the Nationalist Socialist Party. Rosenberg is immensely powerful in the Reich. He is the early ideologue of Nazism. He is a believer in the awakening of the racial type and writes, "For Germany, the Jewish question is only solved when the last Jew has left the greater German space." De Waal writes, "I picture Rosenberg, slight and well-dressed, leaning on the huge buhl table in Ignace's salon overlooking the ring, his papers arrayed in front of him. Above his head is Ignace's carefully calibrated hymn to Jewish pride in Zion, his lifetime bet on assimilation, the grandiose gilded picture of Esther crowned as Queen of Israel. Above him, to his left, is the painting of the destruction of the enemies of Zion. But ironically, there are to be no Jews on Zionstrasse." There is no longer a Palais Effrussi, and no longer an Effrussi bank in Vienna. The Effrussi has been cleansed from the city. De Waal goes to the Jewish archive in Vienna to look up family documents. To his chagrin, he finds that his grandparents' names have been erased and changed to Israel and Sarah. So De Waal tells us, the family was not erased, it was written over. And finally he writes, "It is this that makes me cry." Thank you. My thanks to Professor Henry Ferendo for his explanation of the Lebensborn program.